table to introduce ourselves. And we've got two newer members here, Steve Becker and Adrian Fairbanks. If you just say a couple sentences about yourself. They started on the council in October, so I'm not sure if everybody's met. I'll start with Mark Collier, and I represent some of the installers, designers, and operation maintenance specialists.
I'm Pat Shaw, and I'm a public health nurse and manager here at Clark County Public Health for Nurse Family Partnership, Children with Special Health Care Needs Program, and HIV Prevention.
I'm Cindy Meyer, I run a diabetes program manager for chronic disease prevention.
Jeff Arbison, I'm the Chief Administrative Officer here at Clark County Public Health.
My name is Trista Zugel-Bensel, and I'm with my health.
Ella Milnick, I'm the Public Health Director of Health Office.
My name is Nick Preston, I'm the President of Bush 911, and I'm the
Chairman. I'm a student nurse at University of
I'm Steve Becker, and I'm here as a citizen at large. My day job is with the Baker Hughes Services, and I can't work with them.
I'm Adrian Fairbanks, and I'm a small animal veterinarian and
I'm Paul Shoulders. I represent the restaurants of Southwest.
I'm Roxanne Wolf. I'm the Chief Operations Officer.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley. I'm a nurse, but I'm actually on the council as the non-elected representative of the City of Vancouver.
My name is Greg Nolk. I'm a home health physical therapist, and I represent the consumer public health.
I'm Stephanie Roy Samashta. I'm a nurse representing nurse working in Clark County. I work at Peace Health in mental health.
I'm Lydia Gurman, and I'm an administrative assistant with Clark County Public Health.
Don Strick, I'm the communications manager for Clark County Public Health.
And Janice Koch, I'm the chief performance officer at Clark County Public Health.
And we have one more new member, Amy Bishop Smith. And she basically got permission from the executive board, I think for the first couple of months. She wasn't able to attend the meeting, but she seems real interested. So the executive committee thought she was worth giving a waiver for a couple of meetings attendance, but I'm sure she'll be attending as soon as she can. The next item on the agenda is approval of the November minutes that we have. Can you just take a minute to look at it? And if anybody has any comments or... several items on that. The first one's a grant status update. And I'm not sure if Jeff or Alan is doing that.
I wouldn't cover the Sagehunter Assessment Grant, and we have Cindy Meyer talk about summer grants.
Sounds good.
So the modified toxic control accounts is a state focus that the Department of Ecology oversees. It relies on tax revenue avoided oil. The price of oil is obviously plummeted. The tax revenue is no longer sufficient to fund all those projects in the state. So we have lost our site hazard assessment grants. It's funded a full FTE in our solid hazardous waste program. There's still a lot of effort at the state level to get that funding restored to another source, but the state might commit some money somewhere. Confidence is not terribly high, but there's still work going on. So you have several grants to talk about.
So the most recent one is the marijuana tax fund dollars, which we partnered with ESB 112 on that proposal. They are the organization that they're passing through some nice money for us to do some work. So through that, we're receiving $167,000 that will cover a year and 3 months of work under the marijuana tax fund and another $26,000 from their tobacco funds. That they're going to provide to us. And what we'll be doing with that is working on some policy development related to what we can do in the community around extending our SIP laws a little bit further and perhaps some work around marijuana. The community awareness and education piece is a big part, support for youth prevention coalitions. We also are funding some work around ACEs out of that funding. Two educators will be local educators able to speak around the community, some website development, and some additional presentations in large scale. Known speakers will bring in, and a youth project doing a poster and video contest to promote the prevent messaging and sort of positive life messaging. And we also recently received Kaiser Permanente funding. I don't know if you covered that in the previous meeting. So Kaiser Permanente has given us a three-year grant of $250,000 to increase physical activity along the Fourth Plain Corridor. So we have a number of partners that we're working with on that, including the City of Vancouver, Bike Clark County, Vancouver School District, Americans Building Communities, faith organizations, our community health worker pilot, and other people. So it's been a really, many things, it's not a huge amount of money each year, but it's really brought partners together to kind of get going. And we built that proposal on top of the Fourth Plain Forward project that the City of Vancouver has put together, and our P4HM that worked on that same catchment area. So what we're focusing on is increasing physical activity, so we're looking at built environment, a lot of youth engagement. We're creating a bike to leadership program between Vancouver School District and Bike Clark County, where we'll be training young people to be teaching the bike and pedestrian classes to younger kids, and also doing a lot of things to help Bike Clark County become a more sustainable operation. We're doing worksite engagement, the worksite wellness, and community engagement like park cleanups, a Zumba in the park kind of program, walking groups, faith-based activity groups, and other things. And then we're also using local events to promote this and kick off the physical activity. So events through the Vancouver Summer Adventure, Sunday Streets Alive, we're resurrecting the Fourth Plain Cultural Festival, and some other things like that. And then the third grant is the USDA Farm to School grant, which is giving us $100,000 over 2 years. And that is just what the name of it implies. We're trying to increase procurement of locally produced food products and purchasing practices at Vancouver School District. So working with two schools. And as part of that, we're also teaching the kids about what farms are about the local food system. We'll be developing a curriculum for farm field trips with WSU Extension out to the 78th Street Farm, and developing a blueprint for that program. So we're a busy bunch, but a lot of fun work. That's
it. For the ACE educators, you know, how will people access that information?
So one of the first things we're doing very soon is putting together our website for the ACEs Action Alliance. I'll be talking about that a little bit more in the report under ACEs. But we'll be listing on there ways to contact us if you want to speak, and we'll also be putting links to individual speakers. But a really good way is to just give me a call or an email message, and I can help link you up with speakers. Okay. So I don't have the exact details yet about how we'll get those people out to the community, and one of the charges we have under that grant is to actually develop ACEs education for youth so that we can start educating them about trauma and what to do if they've experienced trauma.
Any other grant questions?
Okay, the next topic is ethics, the ventilator update.
So if we were to have a mass pandemic, actually it's redundant, pandemic of respiratory illness, severe respiratory illness, it's quite possible that the demand for ventilators and critical care beds will exceed the supply. So we're actually going to be bringing this to our ethics committee as to how we're going to make decisions. We're running by the ethics committee. How do we make decisions about who gets a ventilator and who doesn't get a ventilator? Or who gets a critical care bed and who doesn't if we have a shortage? It kind of sounds like a grim possibility. It's remote, but it's not. It's part of our disaster planning, and we need to be prepared for that. And a pandemic assumes that we're not going to be able to get ventilators or critical care supplies from neighboring counties, because everybody's going to be facing the same thing if we have a massive new flu pandemic. The first step of this is to bring a group of critical care physicians, emergency room docs,
together to basically talk about, to develop some clinical guidelines around how we might be allocating these ventilators and agreement on certain some principles, which we did. Alden was there, and feel free to add anything that I leave out. I'll give a pretty big, an overview of what we did. I'm not going to get into the details. But we did decide, we agreed on certain principles, like every life has the same value, that the ethics of in a pandemic situation, when there's not enough supply, unlike the regular world, when there is more than enough supply, when there isn't enough ventilators to go around, the decision to remove somebody from a ventilator is the same, has the same weight as a decision whether or not to put somebody on a ventilator. So we reached agreements on that. We decided, you know, there are different schemes that you could use to decide how to allocate ventilators. For example, it could be first person, first served, which didn't make a whole lot of sense. If we had, for example, if we had folks on ventilators who are basically in a chronic vegetative state, and then we had this pandemic, and we had some folks who the only chance of survival to live a normal life would be to be a ventilator. We wouldn't want to just do a first come, first serve kind of scheme for that. So we came up with some basic scoring system for how this might work. And then once we finally, we have a subcommittee that's fleshing it out, and then once we finally have that done, we're going to bring it to our ethics committee and try to vet this with the community at large. We agreed on three sets of three different variables, if you want to use that term, for how we would have a scoring system. One would be that what's the likelihood of this person surviving the initial hospital stay? What's the chance of them even making it to get out of the intensive care unit, making it off the ventilator? That would be one aspect of the score. Another one would be how many years of a life could you expect if this person survives that hospital stay? For example, if you have two 30-year-olds both needing a ventilator and there's only one ventilator and one of them has end-stage liver disease, it would tilt the decision over to the person who's otherwise healthy. So that was another scoring item. And then the third one was we did not want to value elderly people any different than young people. So what we came up with was the opportunity to live through all the phases of life. So we figured that treating people equally, everybody should have a chance to be a child, to be a teenager, to be a young adult, to be a middle-aged adult, to be retired, and to be elderly, and that we would base another score, and we're not sure how to weigh all of these yet, on everybody having an opportunity to live through the different phases of life. Certainly weights young people higher, but it doesn't discriminate based on age if we take this perspective into account. So we're working on that. Once we have the scheme put together, we are going to bring it to the ethics committee because it shouldn't just be a decision of clinicians. We really want to have a community discussion about this, and that's the next phase. And you guys are welcome. Don, I think we can have other people come join the ethics committee if you want to participate in the community-wide deliberation on that. It sounds kind of grim, but you really don't want to wait until there's an epidemic and there's not enough ventilators around to make a decision. It'd be nice to have these guidelines ahead of time so that we're not, it'll be as horrible as the situation might be, it'll be easier if we've already achieved some community buy-in. The other decision that we made is that the treating clinicians' first obligation is to their individual patient, and we didn't think it was fair to have the treating physician make the decision to remove ventilators. So we talked about having a triage team that would be made up of a critical care physician, a critical care nurse, and an ethicist. And this would be a countywide triage team that would actually use these guidelines to make the decision to remove or put somebody on ventilators when there was a shortage. And they would be rounding, I think, every day, right? Or even several times a day, to depending on how this worked out. So it sounds kind of grim, but it's really remote that anything like this would happen. We figured it should be part of our preparedness plan. Alden was there, if you want to add anything.
It actually was a really, really good discussion. It brings up a lot of the principles that we're trying to end up in a just situation where people are treated fairly and just. So we want to have this sort of thing ahead of time. Tom did a great job of organizing things ahead of time. Great participation from a number of physicians for infectious disease to the primary critical care. And I think that this group is not done yet. There's still a lot more work to do. But I think it will present the opportunity for a great basis from which to move forward.
We have a core ethics committee that's been trained to do these and the steps, go through this deliberation, but anybody, any of you would be welcome to join and participate in that. I think it'll, if we get too many people, we can break up into small groups and do it. So I've done this before.
How many failures are there in the
I didn't bring my notes with me, but that's one of the piece of data that we're going to collect. So we'll measure the number of them. They're located at both hospitals, as well as some of the long-term care facilities have them. And by the way, we also agreed we need to vet this through the hospitals too, because we felt that whatever door you go through, whether it's Peace Health or Legacy or when you show up, your chances of getting on a ventilator should be the same regardless of where you show up. It should be based on the schema. So we have a lot of work to do along with this with our hospital partners as well. We had representatives from Peace Health as well as Legacy there, so I think that'll move along pretty well. But we're tallying the number of ventilators that we have. But the bottom line is it won't be anywhere close to what we need if we had some sort of horrible pandemic.
What about medical supply houses I'm not sure what the medical supply houses are in this area, but you know that have these available organizations to rent or lease?
Yeah, we'll be tallying up everything we have, but everybody will be asking for basically the same thing. And the other thing, I mean, so there's going to be a shortage no matter what we end up with. The other ideas that we came up with were some folks who don't get a ventilator, there might be a way to give them a less invasive ventilation. Mm-hmm. So there's procedures you can use. Yes.
There's a couple of things that anesthesia machines can be used in ventilators, so you would not have a surgery.
Yeah, we'll stop that.
So a lot of good thought went into bringing folks together. I think it's really good.
And by the way, if there's a shortage of ventilators, regardless of what else is out there, there's also going to be a shortage of critical care nurses and critical care physicians and respiratory therapists to basically run these things. So we use the term ventilators, but there'll be a shortage of every resource that goes into.
And they would not be immune from being there also.
Right. So that's grim, I apologize, but let me know if you want to participate. Let us know if you want to participate in the deliberations.
So you would include in that count the skilled nursing facilities or right behind my house there's an adult family home that specializes in vent patients. And so you would include those in your accessibility?
Yes.
Cool.
We would commandeer every ventilator. So some people may be taken off ventilators. And the other thing that we did come up with is that if people were removed from ventilators, we'd have an obligation to provide palliative care and keep them as comfortable as possible. But yes, we would be looking at every available ventilator in the
even like personal ones. I have patients, they're wheelchair bound, they have vents on their wheelchairs, things like that. So you'd be looking at those devices as well.
Yes.
So if a person has their own ventilator and it's their own personal property, and they, let's say somebody with ALS who's on a ventilator, you would have the authority to remove them and
well,
their personal.
I think that we're going to have that discussion at the ethics committee. So I think that'll be an interesting discussion. I don't want to presuppose. We came up with some clinical guidelines about how that might work, but that's a really good question, I think. But those are the kinds of decisions we'd be wanting the ethics committee to.
There are individuals who live on ventilators.
Right.
They live productive lives and they work, and some of them are using leased ventilators, and some of them actually have purchased their private property. So.
And that's one of the reasons why, and you might be some help with this, is I think to do this deliberation right, we need to include as many of the stakeholders as possible. So if you know anybody who you think could come from that perspective, whether somebody who's living with a ventilator that way, or somebody they're close with that, we don't expect them to represent everybody in that situation, but their perspective would really come in handy. We do have somebody on our ethics committee who's an advocate for people living with disabilities, but we don't have anybody with ALS, for example, on our. So I think it would be helpful once we have the community-wide deliberation to include those stakeholders as well.
The other thing is we need to include the VA in this, because we have, in the VA there's a lot of folks that, are receiving home care on ventilators, sometimes they're tough to deal with, but I think it's important, they're part of the community. And
you may want to participate as well, it sounds like you want to have some interest.
Yeah, I am interested in this because of the ethical issues.
Yeah, right, and what I've learned in doing this work is that the most important piece is making sure you get all the stakeholders involved. They don't have to be members of the ethics committee, but we do need them to participate in the deliberation, because if we leave out some of the stakeholders here, we'll actually miss the whole point. So we definitely need to include everybody we can.
I don't know if there's anybody from the Department of Social Health Services, but like Greg mentioned, the adult care facilities, there's a fair number of them around.
Yeah, we definitely need to be aware of that and make sure that those folks have an opportunity to deliberate on this. We might find out that
sometimes when you think about this is where we're looking at Clark County, but there's the river, there's the people that are the medical supply houses that serve both sides of the river, and it makes it even more complicated.
So once we're done with our piece, what I'd like to do is share it with our neighbors to the south, and they can go through the same process, or maybe they'll just like our process. You know what I've learned from doing this? If you do involve all the stakeholders, you'd be amazed at how you learn stuff that you wouldn't. It could be that folks with ALS will go along completely with, who are on ventilators, may go along with the scheme. I don't know, but I think we need to get their perspectives there. So, and we will share it with our neighbors to the south.
Next item on the agenda is a RHA update.
I was going to take about 30 seconds for that, but is there other things on there? Go for it. Yeah, let's get her out of here.
So there are some slides that we will bring up. So there was initially a board retreat with the budget office scheduled this Friday. The budget discussion will not be at the retreat, it will happen on February 3rd in a work session. But these are three slides we provided to the budget office on our behalf. So for some of you, this will be deja vu all over again. We have a budget deficit moving into 2017-18, which for those of you who have been here a while, this is regular for us, I think. So the data I'm using so far projects our deficit at $1.5 billion for the 2017-18 biennium. We had a pretty sharp increase in our benefit cost in 2016. Medical, I believe, was like a 14% increase. Dental didn't go up much. PERS is going up again next July after numerous raises. And that PERS is the pension cost for our government employees. Revenue sources are mostly stagnant. We put in for grants, and I said the same level they were prior, and with rising costs, that's just not a workable solution moving forward. Our environmental health fees were last adjusted in 2012. They were implemented in 2013. And we've had an 80% reduction in this funding source from the Department of Environmental Services for our solid and hazardous waste program. And that support is actually to be eliminated in 2019. We were getting $125,000 a year to support this program from DES. In 2015 and 16, it dropped to $72,000. In 2017 and 18, it drops to $25,000, and then in 2019, it's gone. So, of the $1.5 million deficit, our current data is showing a projected $550,000 to $600,000 of that deficit would be mitigated if we can get our fees adjusted by the Board of County Councilors. Again, the fees were last adjusted in 2012. We actually brought them forward in 2014 for the current budget, and the councilors declined to review them. So the fees are based on the VLCC directive from 2012, and that fee should be based on the cost of providing the service. And the non-fee, or what we call a greater good work, would be paid by the county general fund. So greater good work would be like foodborne illness investigation, someone's garbage cans overflowing, or surfacing a sewage in someone's yard or the playground. That's something that we really can't charge a fee for. And the last slide basically talks about our fund balance, which is our savings account, basically. And we're projected to be about $800,000 below our minimum target at the beginning of 2017. And a big reason for that is there was a $1.9 million one-time reduction to our general fund support in the current budget. We were getting about $4.5 million per biennium. And to balance the county's budget, there was some cuts were basically made to some other funds to sort of balance that. Funds that had what were perceived as bloated or higher fund balances than what might be needed. So $1.9 million is what was reduced from our general fund transfer. And also the fee is not being adjusted, but also taking the buyout of our fund balance for the current biennium. Any questions on these three slides? I'll move pretty quick. I apologize.
So I just have like a perspective question.
Yeah.
So like from an individual standpoint, these numbers are very large and very, it sounds very stressful.
Yeah.
So is that an accurate perception or not really?
So our budget annually is about $10 million. This is a biennial figure, so it's about 7.5% of our budget. I've been here a long time. We had a $6 million shortfall several years ago. So it is big. It does mean loss of service if something isn't done. Mm-hmm. And I think any time we lose services, it's drastic. But as far as the size of the shortfall, I've seen bigger. We've dealt with bigger. We've actually transitioned services out. Our clinical services, our work services. We had several other programs, foster care passport, numerous programs that we used to provide that we don't need.
But they still exist?
Most of them.
Okay.
There's
thank
a percentage you. Of our budget that's going to be
Not quite. There are a couple of programs that the state has picked up locally. I think there's one or two that do not exist. So, I have our budget timeline also. Let me ask one more time. Are there any other questions? That's a great question. But I want to make sure I don't.
No, it seems surprising to me that we're in the shortfall thing when the economy's getting better.
So our funding sources are stagnant. Our general fund support does not increase. It's flat. One of the ideas I've actually, and what we're going to be pitching, is to index our general fund support with labor cost increases. So right now I think we're like 25% general fund funded. So if our labor costs go up $500,000, 25% of that would come from that general fund, source. So that would go up with that indexing.
We also, I don't know if Jeff mentioned this, when our labor costs go up and our benefits costs get, we're a department that gets hit twice, because there are some departments in the county like IT that we end up if their costs go up. We pay for the benefits of their workforce also, so our department gets hit kind of twice, and that's why when the cost of benefits go up, we get a significant deficit.
Yeah, the labor costs that I'm talking about in these slides is actually countywide, and it's not in our budget because there's a two-year lag on the county overhead. So what will happen is 2016, these labor cost increases are hitting. 2018, the county overhead will then go up as well. You know, there is some, our share can change. You know, it's based on PCs for IS, it's based on labor for HR. So there's different methods of actually spreading these costs. But collectively, the county overhead will go up in 2018. So I would expect our county indirect charges to also go up. So Trista is here, which is fabulous. I'm gonna pass around the budget timeline. And she can basically walk you through the process, how this works.
There's a lot of information on this piece of paper. It comes down to a few key steps that are going to occur in the county's preparation of its budget for the 17-18 biennium. So we've started working on it already. We're going to be working on it all year long, and it will become effective January 1, 2017. The first thing that happened is actually the second thing on this list, which is the finance team, which consists of the county treasurer and the county manager, the county budget office, and the auditor, meet to set assumptions for personnel costs, county indirects, and to determine, among other things, determine what the fund balance policy is going to be for the upcoming biennium. So that happened on Friday, January 15th. We're still working through some of those items. Right now, we as a budget staff are developing what is considered a baseline for the non-personnel components of the county budget. So all of the goods and services and things like that that you purchase, that the county purchases. Basically, that's just a matter of taking out everything that was funded on a one-time basis, something that you were just going to purchase this one year and take back out of your budget. And you're given a dollar figure, and the departments are given a dollar figure that says, this is the amount of money that you have. Would you like to distribute it differently among the different types of things that you purchase? And we'll be releasing that in the spring. On February 3rd, the council is going to have a work session to adopt their own assumptions. Probably the majority of you know, the council is the legislative authority for county departments, and so they get to set budget levels and determine the number of FTE that the department has.
When you talk about assumptions, does it get to anything like the core functions of public health, you know, in terms of what the things are critical for public health, or does it stay at a higher?
It stays at a high level at that point. Ultimately, ideally, there is a policy and conversation about all of the competing interests that are in front of the council. That will happen, and I'll discuss further, and with the finance team. The initial budget that will be made public is actually the county manager's proposed budget under the charter. In July, budget submissions from the departments are due. So that means that any new request that a department is interested in having funded, in addition to the baseline that I described earlier, so a new initiative, additional things that have come up, there's a written justification and along with some accounting coding that is submitted to the budget office that says this is what we want and this is how much money and this is how many full-time employees we need to accomplish this purpose. Elected officials and individuals from the departments are about that time are encouraged to be meeting with the members of the council and the members of the finance team to discuss their budget proposals and make sure they're well understood. Friday, October 7th, the finance team and the county manager are going to meet to review all of those packages. And the county manager will take the recommendations of the finance team and propose his budget at a work session on October 19th. And then it can, depending upon how long the public testimony takes, it can go until we can roll over to another hearing on October 26th. The county manager will propose his proposed, publish his proposed budget November 1st. There'll be hearings on the 5th, 6th, and 7th if necessary, and that depends upon the amount of public testimony. The council will vote on their, and they will have the opportunity to amend the county manager's proposed budget. That detail as to what's been approved will be available December 19th, and then it becomes effective January 1st. And there are multiple opportunities to be throughout that next two-year period to update the budget, but this is the big policy-focused update of the budget, which is done every 2 years.
Any questions on the county budget timeline? So what we're going to do, we're going to actually have one-on-twos with the council, we're hoping in March, to show them where we are with our budget, talk about fees, talk about some decisions we're proposing on how to address our deficit. They are the policymakers. We can bring them an idea that can say, well, we don't like that direction, I guess something else. So being the policymakers, they definitely get to decide what happens. Any questions on the deficit or how this process works?
Well, the reason I ask is having been through that several years ago, and the services that used to be a part of public health are no longer a part of public health. I mean, it's like, what else exists in the core functions of Clark County Public Health that could be eliminated? There's some things that just have to exist for the public safety, health, and welfare. And that's back to that assumption,
So our goal for FAC was tonight cover this very high level of conversation, talking about the budget timeline, and then February FAC will actually bring you more detail, basically what we're going to bring to the counselors and our one-on-twos, what we're going to be proposing, basically, and then get your input.
And we've had incredible support from the finance folks from the budget office, and I mean Trista's here, has taken her time to be here. They've been very helpful and very supportive. It's like having a consultant right in the department here. And the county manager is very supportive of our program. So we've already had some discussions with him about this, and then we'll be looking at doing these one-on-twos with the counselors beginning in February, right? Is that what you said?
Well, hopefully, late February or March.
You can meet with two of them at a time, because if you meet with three, it's a quorum, and that's public.
I also want to say something that Alan said, just touched on. I've been here 17 years. I've never had a budget I was this engaged, ever. So it's great. I'm interested in her. She's definitely engaged, which is awesome.
It's a great resource. And,
the comment that I had, like on environmental health fees, last time in 2012, I'm on the side, I think the restaurant people more or less supported the fee increase because we felt we were part of it during the process. It wasn't just thrown out in front of us at the last minute.
We will definitely go through that same process, engage the tax and SMAC. 2 years, actually it was last year, the end of 2014, during the 15-16 budget process, we brought fees forward. And it was only a collective 2.4% fee increase across the board. And the councilors did not want to hear it. They did not want to even have it brought to a meeting, basically, a hearing. My data that I'm looking at right now looks like we're going to be between a 9 and like 12% fee increase collectively. But again, that's 4 years of cost increases. So when you keep saying no, eventually those percentages get higher.
Jeff, do you
want to
explain what your TAC and
the
SWAC is?
So TAC is a technical advisory committee, and the SWAC is actually the solid waste advisory committee. We have a food TAC, I'm pretty sure Paul participates with or used.
Right.
We have TACs for most of our environmental health programs. Jeannie Stewart, one of the counselors, used to work with for many, many years. I think like four or five times at least. So the process is we will actually develop our fee proposal and then bring those fees to those tacks, and then they can then get their. We've been very lucky. They've been very supportive of our fees in the past. Even in 2014, when it was a pretty small increase, they were supportive of those tax, of those fee rates.
We forgot already. TAC is
Technical Advisory Committee.
SWAT is all.
So it's basically.
Who would be involved with the technical advisory committee?
It's a program basis. So if it's the solid, if it's the solid waste TAC or SWAT, it's the solid waste providers, right? And the food TAC is restaurant owners.
But then the first one is the technical.
Well, there's a food TAC. There's a drinking water TAC.
Mark's on attack. Do you want to explain?
And yeah, basically it's a group of special people with on-site septic, and we get together quarterly with the health department to review policies or any procedures that need to be discussed, even budget items. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, as our TAC anyway, acts as a group, come out with, we try to be all together in support for what we want to do. It's been a great group because we really helped get the new sewage regulations in 2007 approved, which was very controversial. So when at the time county commissioners saw that we were in support of it, I think it made it, and the health department had worked with us, that it made the road a lot smoother.
Yeah, it was really collaborative.
So the best case scenario, just drop my pen across the
table. Like a line of salt.
Best case scenario, we develop our fee proposal. The tax are all supportive.
Something on the floor there.
So the tax are all supportive, and then the Public Health Advisory Council also writes a letter to the council saying that they're supportive as well. That's how it could work.
So, yeah, it's generally made up of folks in the industry that corresponds to the particular program. And you guys are volunteers, right? You voluntarily...
Yeah, we're volunteers. Usually in our group, it's the major players. You know, there's maybe 30, 40 septic installers, and 2-3 are very active. All the designers are active, operation maintenance specialists. Mm-hmm. And the key people in the on-site program attend the meetings too.
It's really helpful to us because we can bounce stuff off to work with the industry.
Yeah, and I think over the years we've developed a better relationship with the higher level management here. Alan's attended, Roxanne's attended, so it makes everybody feel like we're kind of working together.
Mm-hmm. And same thing with the restaurant industry or kind of that?
No, I just tell them.
It's not as collaborative.
No, I just tell them, let me tell you how it is. That's all.
We all listen to Paul.
You guys do look like the best dressed guys.
That's it. Next time
you
wear a tie.
Next time you wear a tie.
In the healthy restaurant program that we ran that by the industry, I mean, that's just an example of a great collaboration or a healthy restaurant program with one of our three committees.
Yeah, I usually take it to the association in Olympia and we discuss it and we kind of filter it down to the group here.
It's kind of nice when you kind of work our problems out with each other on that level because when you're in front of the county councilors or the commissioners in the past, you can really disrupt the procedure of the meeting or cause delays and everything, so we try to work out the major items. If we disagree with something, we can still go disagree, but try to work as a group.
And on something like fees, it's very helpful if the industry is going to be paying the fees. Is, you know, we've talked and our fees are basically cost based. And I think you guys were supportive of the 2.41%. Yeah, I mean, our costs were up 4%. And we were proposing a 2.41% increase, and we still didn't get it, but you guys are really helpful. So when it comes to the whole strategy around the budget, we'll be calling on our advisory committees as well as this advisory
committee. But 9% is going to be a little bit high.
Yes. We don't think we're going to get 100% of what we want. Okay. So.
Well, what's interesting is how do you calculate the cost?
Right.
You know, In the private, we can see, okay, we've got a sanitarian out there, he spends an hour at the site. The environmental health support people, you can kind of figure out a cost, but it's all these other costs, the support programs, the computer, and all that. And sometimes, you know, that's what needs to be explained to us, and it needs, as a private sector, it needs to be reasonable too for who we represent.
I think mine's probably on the lower. I think it'll be more like about 12. And again, it's 4 years of cost.
4 years. Mm-hmm. I know.
I agree with you. That's at one bite, that's a big bite.
Yeah.
That's a problem with not getting an increase for 4 years, because then when you have to propose one to cover your costs, and the money has to come from somewhere.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course.
So we need a bunch of questions, fee questions, timeline, process.
I think it's something with the timelines and everything. Yeah. Probably at some point, our council here be active and possibly give a testimony and some letter writing or maybe a letter all together. Something to keep us informed through the process.
And like I said, I'm hoping next month we can bring you a little bit more of this, not just a very high level.
Sure. Yeah. I would greatly appreciate this information. That's all about.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Yeah. I guess the RHA update?
So RHA stands for Regional Health Alliance. It's actually the Southwest Washington Regional Health Alliance. And for those of you who don't know what it is a consortium. Actually, it's been around since 2009. The hospitals, the managed care organizations, the providers, both the behavioral health providers as well as the physical health providers came together and realized that the way we had a siloed healthcare system where physical health was funded one way and mental health was funded another way and substance use disorder was funded a different way, and we're talking about the low income populations in Medicaid. We had a siloed system where these entities didn't really communicate with each other, and then at the delivery level, you had people who might have coexisting mental health and chronic physical health conditions having to go to many different places to get services, and the care was uncoordinated. So we came together about, well, it was 6 years. And then fast forward to healthcare reform and the Affordable Care Act. The bottom line is, and I don't want to take up too much time here, as the state is divided into regions now, around how the Medicaid dollars are going to flow through the state healthcare authority, and in most of the regions, in virtually all the regions except ours, they're combining substance use and substance use disorder and mental health into something called the Behavioral Health Organization, and they're going to administer the Medicaid program for those two things, so they'll be integrated, and then physical health will be done through managed care organizations. Clark and Skamania counties are Region 9. We are the only region in the state. By the way, I should backtrack. By 2020, all the care will have to be completely integrated. State law, it was Senate Bill 24, whatever, it was 13 or whatever. I'm getting the number wrong. There was an option to do something called early adopter. We Clark County and Skamania County, the only region in the state that actually going to go to full integration as of April 1st, 2016. So starting April 1st, there will be no, the mental health agency in the past is called the Regional Support Network, the RSN, that'll go away. There won't be a behavioral health organization here. What we will have in Clark and Skamania counties is that all the Medicaid funding for behavioral health, which is mental health and substance use disorder, and physical health, will all go through managed care organizations. So anybody on Medicaid will get all their services through managed care organizations. There was an RFP done a few months ago. Two managed care organizations got the contract. And won the RFP, and that is Molina and the Community Health Plan of Washington. They're busy getting their provider contracts in order, but as of April 1st, they will be the two managed care organizations providing services, integrated behavioral health and physical health to the Medicaid populations in this region. There's also going to be an entity called the VHASO. which is Behavioral Health Administrative Services Organization. And it gets kind of complicated, but with the RSN going away, there's some non-Medicaid programs that still have to be delivered. For example, if somebody's, whether they're on Medicaid or whether they're on private insurance, if they have a mental health crisis, they need crisis services that they can't get through their regular providers. So this BHASO will be providing crisis services as an example. So that's that contract is in place, or that entity has been awarded. They're called Beacon, and they have their national organization, and they have a lot of experience doing this work. So that goes into play on, that all comes in on April 1st, 2016. That's part one of the RHA update. Any questions about that? So the Southwest Regional Health Alliance, which has actually supported this move all along, just got designated, won the designation to be something called an ACH, which is Accountable Community of Health. And each one of these regions is going to have an ACH. And the role of the ACH is not clearly defined yet. Part of the next couple of years we'll be defining what the role of the ACH is. But it will have our you know, we already have some roles. One is we're required to do a regional health improvement plan that we'll be working with. The RHA will be working, talking to our department about, because we've already done some components of that, namely our community health assessment, which we might be able to use. There'll be some oversight around data and monitoring the system and looking at how healthcare is being delivered. We're actually working on developing something called an early warning system to see if things don't go very well, you know, what kind of red flags might there be. We're developing a learning lab to look at different models of healthcare transformation. So there'll be a lot of roles that the ACH is playing, and that's still being worked out. So that's kind of the update, and I wish I could explain it better than that, but it gets confusing for me, and I've been in the midst of it for a while.
That is the best explanation I have heard.
Really?
One of the most complicated topics I have ever had to deal with.
Well, yes, thank you. I'll get that as a compliment.
That is a significant issue to the whole mental health and chemical dependency treatment world. It is huge.
So I'm really excited what we're going to be able to do here, because we're going to be, you know, we're integrating it not only financially, but also in terms of service delivery, and we're looking at not only co-location of behavioral health providers and physical health providers in their respective shops, so putting primary care in behavioral health office, putting behavioral health providers in primary care offices. We're also looking at doing a lot of care coordination, sharing data, even having a community health worker component that basically connects people to what we call the social determinants of health. So not only do you get integrated behavioral health and primary care, but if you need housing or employment, some of those issues are being dealt with at the same time. So it really is kind of exciting, but you know, we have a long way to go, and it's pretty complex. That's all I have to say about it. Probably more than enough. Okay.
The next item is Public Health Community Awards. Public Health Week, and I think Don's going to speak on that.
Okay, so in your packet, you'll see a nifty little form here, which is for the award, and this is actually one of the fun activities that Public Health puts on annually. The CARES event is going to take place at the Board of Health meeting at the end of April. It's actually on April 27th. And it kicks off the meeting. It takes place right before, from 8:30 to 9. There is a breakfast event. The winners are acknowledged by the board. And it's really quite festive. It's a lot of fun. And the purpose of the award is to showcase an individual and or an organization that has made significant contributions to public health. And there's a little description about why we do the award here on page 2 of the award. And then the form itself, and it includes the criteria, and basically, you know, we're looking especially for people or organizations that have a significant partnership component and also a community-wide impact but also these other criteria that are listed here. So we'd love your help in getting the word out, sharing these forms and distributing them, and also submitting your own nominations, because I'm sure each of you probably has great ideas of very eligible people and organizations in the community. I'll pass this out. It has a summary of award winners in previous years, and that will give you an idea of the kinds of people and organizations that we've honored. And so, yeah, give it some thought, and if you have any nominations, don't wait to send them in. We always stress out if it's getting up against the deadline. We have two nomination forms in, so send them in early. That would be terrific. We also would very much welcome anybody who would like to serve on our award evaluation on the selection committee. So if you want to sit in on that, we historically have had one or two people from FAC on the committee helping us make the selection, and that's kind of a fun one-time, 1 or 2 hour event, depending on the number of nominations. Let me see if there's anything else. We're going to be putting a link to the form on our website. It will be fillable online, so people can just fill it out and then email it directly to Lydia. I'm also going to put out a news release in a few days publicizing the award and soliciting nominations. Last year's winners, it's not on here because that hasn't been updated, were Melody Shear at the New Day Clinic, and the organization was Battleground Healthcare, which is a nonprofit that provides help, care for low-income individuals. And that's pretty much it. Does anyone have any questions?
So if we have a nomination, then the committee will go and research more and contact them individually or the organization individually to learn more about it. Is that how?
Sometimes, I mean, our committee basically goes off of the information that is provided to us on the form. Yeah. If there are, in certain cases where we need more information, we might do some extra research or call up.
So they wouldn't have any idea that they're being nominated necessarily?
Not necessarily, but they'll know in advance because we announce the winners in advance.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess you'd like a couple volunteers to assist.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to volunteer now, that's fine. Otherwise, send me an email if you want to give it some thought.
It was tough deciding last year.
Okay, well, I'll send the group an email beforehand to solicit some volunteers.
Well, the next item is just a little information on the executive committee. Basically, there's three of us that are on it, the chair, the co-chair, and a member at large. And I'm the chair, and then Stephanie is the co-chair, and Andriana is the members at large. And basically, we meet a week before this meeting and come up with the agenda. Staff kind of puts together some ideas and everything, and then we kind of go through the agenda and modify or add or take away on it. Also, if anybody has any questions whatsoever or comments, feel free to contact any three of us. If there's any questions. Okay. Next part is the program update on the nurse-family partnerships and information on ACEs, too. And I guess Pat's...
So, Mark, sorry to interrupt, but I was going to just give a quick update on Chris Goodwin.
Oh,
I just wanted to do that real quick
before
we apologize.
Yeah, I noticed it wasn't here.
So. Okay, it's as you know, we were looking to hire a partnerships coordinator. And the first year, probably what they'll be doing is taking some leadership on the community health improvement plan. As a reminder, this council has agreed to be the steering committee for the community health improvement plan, also known as the CHIP. We have hired someone. His name is Chris Goodwin. He is from this area, but he's currently working in New York. And so he will be moving here and starting in his position February 19th. So because of his role, he'll be doing a lot of orienting before he gets really buried into the CHIP for the Community Health Improvement Plan work. So I just wanted to give you a heads up. He'll probably not be here in February, but he'll be at this meeting in March, I hope. to get to know you guys, learn more about the council, and start his orientation and thinking about how we want to approach the CHIP. That's it.
And his background, again, is, what is he doing?
It's really good. I know, I was just looking on here to see if I could have access to my G drive, which I don't. He has a public health background. Mm-hmm. He was a, what kind of fellow was it again? Do you remember, Roxanne?
It's CDC fellow. Actually, it's the
practice
public
fellow.
Health associate. The yeah. FAP program to the FAP. CDC, yeah.
There's a lot of acronyms.
I know, right?
Yes.
But a CD, basically was a CDC fellow. Excellent program.
Yeah, he seems, from his references, they just really said he has a lot of initiative. He can really take a project and run with it, and that he has a lot of experience doing outreach right now. He's, I think he's worked with the New York Public Health Department, but he's doing a program for... with youth. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I'll make sure to have him share all his background when he shows up.
It would be nice to have just like a little bio, just like the, yeah. have him just give you a little bio.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be nice.
Great idea. I'll make a note.
Okay, for the Mayor's Family Partnership,
yeah.
I'm not sure if Brock.
So, Pat and I are going to tag team this, this discussion. So, Jeff was mentioning some of our budget issues, and we wanted to talk to you about the Nurse Family Partnership, because this is one of the programs that we're looking at in terms of how do we continue to fund it going forward. And Pat is our program manager for Nurse Family Partnership, and she's been integral in this discussion, not only with the leadership team, but with our team, with the nurse team, with regard to this, putting together a strategy going forward. So, first, I'd like Pat to give a little bit of a background about what Nurse Family Partnership is, and then I can get into some of the details about the budget issue and then where we're going with our strategy. So,
So Clark County Public Health has provided Nurse Family Partnership since 2007. We have four public health nurses who are specially trained in the program. Nurse Family Partnership is for first-time, low-income, pregnant teens or women. We have no age limitation. We have a lot of teens on our caseload and a 42-year-old woman right now. So the goal of Nurse Family Partnership is to have a healthy pregnancy and healthy delivery, the child of the client be ready for school, and that the mom and family be self-sufficient as the years go by. So the nurse visits every week to 2 weeks, starting as early in pregnancy as possible, but before 28 weeks gestation, and visits the mom and then the child till the child turns 2. So it's a very well-researched model, a lot of emphasis on life goals for that mom, usually focusing first very much on the pregnancy and having a healthy baby, but also speaking of adverse childhood experiences, you know, what kind of parenting did that mom have, and what would she maybe like to have be different? And dad too, we involve the fathers whenever is possible. Might they like to have, how might they like things to be different for their own child? So, so a lot of emphasis on the mother finishing her education, and the father, if he's in the home, and maybe going on to another level, higher ed, career options. A lot about parenting, big care coordination role. These are public health nurses, and there's a large health focus, but as public health nurses, we look at the person in their whole environment and what their needs are and how we can help them achieve their goals. Let's see what else might be helpful for you guys to know about it.
And I think it's important to share, there's tons of data about
right. Yes.
cost savings to mm-hmm. investment, you know, $20,000 return on investment to the communities.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research done on that, and so it's a pretty big upfront cost. But down the road, with increased self-sufficiency, the mother's less likely to be reliant on the TANF or welfare system. Is one example of the longer-term return on investment. In the short term, it's babies not as likely to be premature, so costs from that perspective too.
Depend on the kids even 15 years from
right. Yeah, less juvenile delinquency, less mother time in jail.
More likely to graduate from high school, I believe.
Excellent.
Smarter kids, better language.
It's been studied in randomized clinical trials going back 30 years, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that, starting in like Elmira, New York.
77.
Yeah. The nurses collect a lot of data, and I get quarterly reports about how Clark's program is doing compared to Washington as a whole, and compared to the national rates. We shine in areas like immunization rate. By the time the kiddos are 24, we're like the best. We're very high for that. Breastfeeding rate at 6 months, spacing of pregnancy, because family planning and planning for future children is a big part of NFP too. So. Those are other examples of areas where we're doing
it's been
quite
shown
well.
To reduce short interval pregnancy, which is mm-hmm. within 18 months or less from one. Those are higher risk. I think it's been shown, the NFP program has been shown to reduce that by a third, mm-hmm. a significant amount. So it's mm-hmm. another positive outcome.
So our four nurses are each 0.8 FTE. The last time we had a budget, well, sometime back, 3 or 4 years now. Budget crisis, they volunteered to reduce their 1.0 FTE to 0.8 so that they wouldn't lose a nurse. And so the NFP model is 25 clients per 1.0 FTE, so our nurses 20 clients per 0.8 FTE. Any questions about the program itself?
How did people get matched up to the program?
That's a really good question. Yep. So a lot of our referrals come from physicians in the community. Mm-hmm. Some come from maternity support services, which happens at CMAR. We have a very strong working relationship with the GRADS program. That's the teen to parent program classroom in the Evergreen and Vancouver school districts. We get a lot of referrals from them. We were getting a lot from CUP. We hope to be getting a lot from Molina. So those are some examples.
And I know you were talking about like identifying some services that they might need. Did you have a partnership to help with like housing needs?
Well, I think yes. We work closely with the Vancouver Housing Authority when they have opportunities for us to learn, or not just Vancouver Housing Authority, the Council for the Homeless. We have staff that are there to say, you know, what's on the horizon, you know, how can we better get our low-income pregnant clients into housing, and that's become quite a concern. And I was at a Nurse Family Partnership Program Manager statewide meeting last week. Seattle is having a huge issue with homelessness for their clients, so the nurse will get the address of the tent behind the fence at the church on such and such street, and not to that point. We have more couch surfing type of clients, typically not living out of their car, but they're probably out there and we may not be reaching them. But
because I think when we had that homeless story, that was there was a couple of pregnant women
that were in the tents down by Share House.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're not reaching by any means the need that's out there. Mm-hmm. So that's another piece of this is that it is also a struggle with getting referrals into NFP, but there's still a lot of folks out there that could use these services that are not getting access to the services yet. So
is there a long waiting list? I mean, is it?
So actually, we've had more referrals than we've been able to serve. That's kind of dropped off with CUP not referring as many to us, but the nurses have been able to keep pretty full caseload, so that's been good. But it's something we need to be somewhat vigilant about. So
does that involve then, like that partnership piece of going out into the community to make sure that? Because I'm wondering about like if you have a teenager who's dropped out of school already, and who might they see that would let them know that that's a possibility?
Well, hopefully they would hear about WIC, so they might hear them. And then when people go to WIC, which is at CMAR, they hear about another program called Maternity Support Services, which is a less intense program. But and they will often refer first-time
pregnant. Okay.
Clinic, if they're going for prenatal care, they might hear from their clinic.
Okay.
So this is a, you know, obviously a very important program for public health and for the community. The challenge always is with the budget issues that Jeff was talking about, we in public health have to look at the criteria of how do we look at how we spread the funding, the lack of funding, through our existing programs. Mm-hmm. And so there's several criteria that we look at. One of them is, is the service mandated? So, for instance, there are some services with their environmental health team, for instance, that are mandated services. CD, that sort of thing, infectious disease control, those sorts of things that are mandated that we have to provide. So we have to maintain funding for those programs. Another thing is, what programs do we have a significant amount of grant funding for? And what programs may come more out of the general fund, which is part of the problem that we've got because that general fund is dwindling. So there's several different ways that we look at when we're looking at programs and what we do in situations like this, what we can maintain and then what we may not be able to maintain. So this program is extraordinarily important to us, as I mentioned before. This is one of the only evidence-based programs that we have in public health. It has been recognized by the state. In fact, it's been recognized in the nation as being one of the programs that really does have these downstream outcomes that we can really measure and reproduce over and over and over again. There's a lot of dialogue right now about scaling up NFP in the state of Washington. There's several proposals that are floating around out there that are going to be for the Medicaid waiver to potentially use Medicaid dollars for NFP in a scaled up way in the state of Washington. Those things, however, are downstream. They're more long term fixes for the NFP program. They're not something that would that would come into play this year, probably even in 2017, possibly, but it's more of a long term strategy. So what we have to look at is really that 2017-2018 budget period and how do we maintain these services, because that's our goal. Our goal is to maintain them within public health or at the last resort to maintain them in the community, because we don't want these services to go away in the community. They're greatly needed. You know, as Pat and, Cindy's talking about ACEs later when we're finished talking to you about NFP. But NFP is one of the programs that focuses very closely on ACEs, on substance abuse prevention, on parenting, on all of these things that have these proven downstream effects for us from public health. So one of the things we've been doing is Pat has graciously come in early on and has really helped the leadership team to develop a strategy and approach that we're going to be taking. And we'll be talking to the FAP a little bit more about what we're going to be asking you to do with support going forward. And I may be contacting some of you that have contacts with some of the community partners that we're going to be wanting to talk about this situation. But we are going to start working with our community partners. We've identified a list of priority community partners that we're going to be talking to about sustainable funding for this program going forward. And it's probably going to be more of a community focus. One of the things that NFP has said is that sustainable funding really comes from a variety of sources. And so that's what we're looking at. We're looking at building not just let's prop this program up for 2017-18, but we really want to look at a sustainable model going forward, mm-hmm. to not only keep these services here, but potentially even look at expansion later on down the line, if it makes sense. So we've prioritized a list of community partners that we're going to be having a dialogue with. We're also going to be talking to some of our hospital systems our and the health plans as well. They're a piece of this. We're going to be talking to our board of counselors, the one-on-twos that Alan and Jeff were talking about with regard to the budget. NFP is going to be part of that discussion. So we have a whole timeline of how we're going, who we're going to discuss this with, and how, and basically the message points that we're going to be talking to them about. So we've put this initial strategy together. I think the initial community outreach, it's already started. We're talking to you. We've talked to some other strategic partners already. So this is going to probably start getting out in the community. If you have any suggestions for us, though, about who you think we should contact, that would be fantastic. And we always welcome any feedback that you might have. And as I mentioned, we'll be probably talking with you individually about contacts that you may have with some of the community partners that we've prioritized to talk about. But we'll also be coming back to you probably in the next 2 or 3 months Once we see what kind of support we have in the community, we'll be coming back to you to ask for some, you know, some support, probably with the Board of Counselors and some other. Do you agree, Alan?
We really do need to look for sustainable funding for this.
We wanted to just give you an update as we move forward. We wanted to let you know what the situation is and what our criteria is for looking at these programs when we have these budget issues. Jeff's going to be coming back next month, and we'll have an update for you there too, and we'll let you know kind of how it's going with our community partners and with the discussion. Ultimately, we probably need to get the sustainable funding and our partners in place within the next 6 months. If we don't get those in place in the next 6 months, and we're looking at if we can't either keep it in public health or we can't keep it in the community, then we're going to have to start transitioning people out of service and not be accepting anymore into service. And that's really what we want to avoid. So we've got a six-month window here that we're going to be doing a ton of work. And your support and your feedback is going to be really critical during that time.
Do you have an idea of who some of the partners you're thinking of?
Yeah, so our prioritized partners, we're going to start with ESD 112 and the Prevent Coalition. That's one of our first partners. They have the grads program that Pat had referred to before that is really central to, and a lot of our clients right now are teenage moms, and so it fits very well with ESD 112.
I mean ages in the teens, yeah. Right? It's like 17 or yeah. So, or what's some, yeah. We have 14-year-olds in the program, don't
yeah.
We?
Yeah, unfortunately 13-year-olds.
13. Yeah, the mean age is teenagers. I mean, that's, we're talking about a very high-risk
right.
population, and they get great outcomes with a very high-risk population. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
And obviously, this is potentially like a national program, from what you said.
It is.
What are the other? I mean, obviously, they probably have the same problems that have been the same funding. What are some of the solutions?
So, the home visiting dollars out of the Affordable Care Act have come to communities. Unfortunately, when Clark County Public Health applied, we did not get those federal dollars. We learned from that experience that we really needed to be focusing on the central Vancouver area where we have the higher rate of need, and then maybe we would have gotten those. So only two counties did not get the federal home visiting dollars. Those come through Department of Early Learning and then distributed by Thrive Washington. So Thrive was generous and said, well, for you, those of you who didn't get that, we'll do another grant opportunity. And they were only as generous as they could be using state dollars. They go into the home visiting services account. And so we're on our third year of a $50,000 grant. We also have the opportunity to use maternal child health block grant dollars. And so for right now, we're using those. That money, but it's kind of a drop in the bucket, is a big term Jeff would use. When we look at the full budget and what is needed, the challenge too is sometimes when these grant opportunities come, like through Thrive and Department of Early Learning, they're for expansion. They're not to support what we're currently doing. So an example is TANF, so the temporary aid to need families. Somehow that program in DSHS has extra money. So they have an RFP coming out where we would work, we would enroll a lot of people on TANF, we'd enroll them in NFP, who are already on TANF, and then we would be funded to do that. But again, that's expansion, so I plan to apply, but I don't know if it's realistic till we know how we can sustain the program.
And that federal money is now, that grant is now.
I've heard that there may be an opportunity in the future. So in 08, a statewide nurse home visiting, a statewide home visiting assessment was done. So there's some other programs out there, some of which are considered evidence-based too. So Early Head Start is one, as well as Parents as Teachers. They're not the broad, as encompassing as NFP is. But let's see, where was I going with that? Anyway, so there may be an opportunity in the future, but I think they need to redo that home visiting needs assessment because, again, it didn't show Clark to be as in high need. But we know the need is there. It's certainly there for every one of the clients that we serve, and we have a large Medicaid birth rate in our community too. So anyway, that's kind of where we're at. We've been stuck
are now and aren't eligible for those federal home visiting dollars, but I've heard we might.
And if you were, is that, I mean, is that a huge, would that revive?
Would
that be sustainable for a long period of time, or is that?
It would help a lot. Some communities are relying heavily on those dollars. Some have, well, again, the braided and blended funding. So some are getting the marijuana tax dollars that go through in our community through Prevent. Some are getting hospital charity dollars. So it, yeah, varies across the state. Some have transitioned from public health to other agencies. Indiana has a Goodwill that does NFP. I've heard of YWCAs in some communities. It's Snohomish County, it's their local. Here we have Innovative Services Northwest, which is a neurodevelopmental center. The equivalent of that in Snohomish County is now the provider of NFP. It's designed to be, I believe, done through public health for a lot of good reasons, and I would like it to continue to live there, but I'm biased.
Well, it's a very prescriptive program, and there's a high level of fidelity that you need to maintain for the program, and it's really required for the program. That's why they have the type of data that they have. So, you know, public health has the infrastructure to be able to do that. Absolutely. And to be able, right, to be able to maintain that program at that level of fidelity that's required. And, you know, one of our concerns that we've been talking about is, would our community partners be able to do that? Or would they be able to do it with the support of public health? And that's a question that we're not sure of. And we have a big concern about that, because it is critical to keep that program fidelity as it is. If we don't have that, then the program is not going to make the, it's not going to hit the outcomes, you know, based on the program model. So it's really critical that you keep that program maintain the way it is.
You know, a few years ago, you know, there was some publicity on the NFP. It was really great publicity in the Columbian, but there was a significant backlash, if you can recall, in the Columbian's online blog. You know, there's elements of the people that don't understand how 13-year-old girls get pregnant and that those are bad girls. And
promoting that or something.
And I think if we think about even the work that we're doing on the ACEs Action Alliance, and, you know, I think that there's, I think it's really important that we be prepared for that, you know, in terms of, we know the positive outcomes, we know the long-range outcomes, we know the savings and law and justice and all of that. But I just remember just being horrified at the comments being made on the online blog when it was a great, it was a cover story in Clark County about this great NFP program and the outcomes. And but there's a lot of folks in our community that don't understand, you know, how this happens. And so I think we really need to, the whole thing of a PR campaign on why is this important, and right, make it data relevant to our county.
Right.
I know, to me, being involved with the health department for so many years, this is one of the programs that
it's a gold standard.
It has the outcomes. You've got the public health nurses running it, doing a good job. They're out looking for services for people, and it's just, to me, it seems like one of the core programs. And what we're looking at is a situation in terms of what it costs to run the health department, you know, the indirect costs. So every administration's forced to look at what programs do we keep, what services are mandated, or how do we fund some of these things.
Right.
And I have a big concern about if it is leads to health department,
right,
that something's going to be lost in the process.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. It
gets back to my question about what are the assumptions about what is it that's essential for Clark County Public Health, and why?
This is an opportunity, though, to see how much support there is in the, you know, this is the opportunity for the community to demonstrate support for the program. I think we all realize how critical it is, but we need to demonstrate community support for it as well.
Yeah, to bring in the evidence is there. I mean, it is the gold standard of evidence-based practice and outcomes. I mean, it is.
Right.
You know, where prevention pays, saves money, improves quality of life. You know, you can't.
And we're all talking about ACEs, and this is an ACEs prevention program.
Absolutely.
And there's definitely a demonstrated return on investment. It's a range, and it depends on the type of, you know, the type of clientele you have in where your cost structure is as well, but there's a demonstrated ROI that you can, you know.
$5.60 on the dollar is the latest numbers I've read, which is a pretty huge return.
Yeah.
I imagine at some point, the council here would be involved in the reserve.
Yeah.
We're just kind of in a waiting position.
We are. So, yeah, we wanted to give you a quick update of where we were with it, and then we'll be coming back to you at the next FAC meeting and let you know. We're intending to start our dialogue with our community partners within the next week to 2 weeks, and then probably with the health plans and with our hospital providers and other care providers sometime in February, and then with the BOCC late February, early March with our one-on-twos. So we'll be bringing you back, you know, where we're at with this, kind of gauging, you know, where we think we are. And at some point we will be asking you for something, probably, you know, some sort of letter of support or something like that. But more than anything, we just wanted you to be informed. We do think it's going to get out there in the community. We think there's going to be some questions, that sort of a thing, and we wanted you to have an update of where we are.
The next item on the agenda is ACES, the training update and progress and diagram.
I'm having a bit of a traumatic event after.
I'm going to get you some water.
We've talked about ACES at this meeting before, adverse childhood experiences, but would anyone like me to kind of reiterate the explanation of what ACES stands for and what that refers to? Okay, so adverse childhood experiences are those potentially traumatic experiences that you might have between birth and about the age of 18 as the brain is developing. And so they're not just things like losing your teddy bear. This is a really serious traumatic event, like, I have a little list here, I have to read them so I forget it, but emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, loss of parent due to divorce, death, or incarceration, living with a mentally ill or drug or alcohol addicted family member, or being exposed to violence. So the reason that we are interested in that from public health is not only, because this might sound more like a behavioral health or a mental health issue, but it actually, there was a huge study with a very large cohort, more than 17,000 patients were involved in this at Kaiser Permanente some years ago, and they got a direct correlation between the number of these types of adverse experiences that you have as a child and your risk for your risk of developing coping mechanisms, first of all, like smoking or drinking or promiscuous sex or whatever it might be.
Drug addiction.
Yeah, pardon me again?
Drug addiction.
Drug addiction that then become a risk factor as you get older and then predispose you to health problems and mental health issues, early suicide, early death, and so on. So when we look at how can we do upstream prevention, ACEs is one of the keys that we really look at. And on top of that, which seems kind of like common sense in a way, but then we found that actually I call it a chemical soup that your body creates of cortisol and adrenaline and things when you're experiencing these traumatic events, when that's bathing your developing brain cells, it actually impacts the way that your brain develops. And you don't always see it immediately, and although you might see it in a child who acts out when they go to the classroom, but it may actually change the way that brain's developing. You see the outcome of that later on when the kid's, say, 12 years old and that brain cell develops. Then they start to have more of these risk factors and so on. So we see it having a real impact on brain development. And then the last thing that we've discovered with study of neuroepigenetics is that it actually can affect the factors on the chromosomes, and the impact it can have on, for example, executive function might end up being an inheritable characteristic for several generations. So we really see this as a key for our work in disease prevention. So what we've done around that here in Clark County is, and Joan, you pipe in any time, because Joan is...
Well, it's a high priority of this council, and I wanted to give a report on that, but go ahead and, you know, our ACEs action lines.
Mm-hmm. I'll just talk about that, and then, yes, I'd love that if you mentioned that. So we started the ACEs Action Alliance, and Joan has been, like, you've been so great. Thank you so much. But right back from the beginning, back in February, we started up this idea of let's get partners together who might be interested. And we're now, I did a little count yesterday, 43 organizations in Clark County are now a part of the Alliance. And we have developed four focus areas for our group. So a lot of this year is spent on developing kind of our infrastructure, our values, our goals, our mission statements, so on. But we have four areas of focus. We work on assessment and evaluation, education and awareness, cross-sector collaboration, and trauma-informed organizations. And each of those four areas has a team leader and a team of people that meet on a monthly basis to work that work forward. And then our whole alliance meets every other month right now. So some of the goals that we have currently are we're developing our baseline assessments. So we're collecting data, some from the Healthy Youth Survey, some from census data, some from different kinds of tracking mechanisms to look at what are the risk factors we have in Clark County that show that how many kids are predisposed to ACEs. What is the data that's showing us, perhaps our jail data on, you know, all different kinds. We're looking at a whole variety of things. And we've been lucky enough to also bring in up at WSU, Clay Mosier, who's bringing in a lot of information about evaluation assessment also on this topic from the past. Then under education, we're developing talking points, presentations, speakers, resources that are all going to be housed in a website that we recently got funding through the Marijuana Fund to create that website to house that. And then under awareness, we're doing presentations, outreach, and events. And under trauma-informed organizations, we're developing, just developed, an evaluation tool that organizations can use to analyze whether they are a trauma-informed organization or not, and if they're not, what their gaps are and how they could move that forward with their staff and their policies and practices. And then lastly, we're developing a filter to make sure that we're being inclusive and representing all sectors, including minority groups, as well as all kind of community sectors. Some of the presentations we've done, I presented to the Home Visiting Association, the Council for the Homeless. We've done quite a bit here at Clark County Public Health. There have been two screenings of a movie called Paper Tigers, which is about the school in Walla Walla, Lincoln High School. There'll be more of those. And we had a panel discussion, and I'll tell you a bit more about some of the upcoming things in a moment. But I wanted to mention that one of our new secret weapons we've got coming up pretty soon is Teresa Everson. So Teresa is a physician with Multnomah County right now, and she's just gone back and is finishing up her master's in public health and is going to be joining us starting this week to do a practicum here for a year. And her area of interest is ACEs, so we get to have Teresa, and we're very excited about that. And I'm kind of hoping that maybe what she'll want to look at is really the medical sector. And we have a lot of interest from Sarah Lewa, who is a physician at the Child and Adolescent Clinic in Salmon Creek, about looking at how can we implement screening in pediatric and OBGYN practices to identify early on people at high risk of ACEs, and what can we do to get them referred to programs like NFP. So we're hoping that Teresa may want to kind of take that on.
I am. So Teresa is a board certified family physician, is actually formerly chief resident in family medicine at OHSU, been practicing for Multnomah County and the RefQHC for 6 years, I believe. So she's got a lot of experience in primary care. She decided to go back and do preventive medicine residency. So she's doing that at OHSU. As part of your preventive medicine residency, you have to do a practical field experience. So she's going to be spending a year with us doing a practicum. So it's a great, and she's very interested in this whole, so it's a great, great resource. She's got a lot of, done a lot of work in reproductive health as well. So great resource.
So I'd say that's one of the great things about ACEs that I found, besides the fact it's not a great thing, ACEs aren't great, but it's a unifying motivator for people in our community to come together and work together. And so that has been a byproduct of an unfortunate thing, is that we are having people really come together and rally together and join together to do something about this. This is a pretty ugly flyer, right, Joan, that I developed for something, but I just wanted to pass it out because it does give you some of the details. It is ugly. Some of the details of what we're doing, and on there is my, it's all split up with a hyphen. There is no hyphen in my email address, so ignore that, but it's at the very bottom here on the left, on the right. And if you would like to be on our distribution list for the Action Alliance, please just send me a little email or let me know, and we'll add you to that.
Our next meeting is, the whole Alliance is Monday, January 25th at 1:30 to 3. It's at the ESC. And I would like if some other members of the council would join us, since this is a priority issue that we identified on the council. And it's a very robust meeting, and we try to have some education and then, you know, have reports from our different groups. And I'm amazed at how quickly we've gotten to this point. One of the things that came up, I might add, in our education and awareness, our last meeting that we're working on is, you know, Stephen Maynard was with us from the cross-sector group, and one of the things that we were talking about is how to target the different sectors. And one of the things that Stephen brought to her, we had a really robust discussion about this, was the fact that we're trying to make the community and health professionals, et cetera, aware of this, and it's not being taught in health professional schools. And so that was something that was new that came out of that meeting we want to target nurses and physicians and practices and social workers and teachers, et cetera. But we also then need to make sure it's being covered in their basic schools of education. That was something because it's really difficult. It's really interesting how this, in the world of healthcare, it's still relatively new. Just a couple of weeks ago, I gave a presentation at the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives, which is nurse leaders in the Portland, Southwest Washington area. Only about 1/4 of this group have even heard about ACEs. And so therein it lies part of our problem of people who are practicing, as well as what's happening in schools of social work. Schools of social work are probably way ahead of the game. But medical schools, nursing schools, of adverse childhood experiences actually being in the curriculum.
So you know, the Kaiser study was done in 1998.
17 almost, years?
Yeah.
Yep, we're at the but 17
it's
years.
Like it took 150 years for people to learn that citrus took care of scurvy.
Well, we know that...
We're way ahead of that curve.
We know that if they say now 17 years to get evidence into practice, and we are...
Yeah.
Think about it. That's
amazing, isn't it? 17 years and we're still just... getting going.
And I talked about this. I mean, Tara's going to get this when I talk in the class about nurse-family partnership, but it's not universal in health professional and social work school. And so then we think about, you know, it's that chicken and egg, you know, and so it's our work on our education and awareness committee is really challenging. And so anybody who'd like to join us, we really would like your help.
What's really exciting to me about this, I'm sorry, I'm probably blabbering too much, but for the first time in my professional career, I could start thinking about primary prevention for mental health and substance use disorder. It wasn't really, nobody really thought about how to do primary prevention there, but this might be a way to really do some primary prevention around that. So unless people have some other ideas, but it's very promising.
If anybody on this council hasn't seen it, there's the TED Med talk by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who's a pediatrician. It's something we should put in the minutes, and every one of you needs to take 15 minutes to watch that, because it will summarize this down into why this is an issue, changing the paradigm of healthcare, and why it belongs to all of us.
What was the name again?
Her name is, I'll get it to...
I don't watch it.
But it's a TED Med by Nadine Burke-Harris.
Excellent.
Burke-Harris. She's a pediatrician. And she does a marvelous case in the TED Med talk of making the case for learning about it.
I think she just received a grant funding to really work on a model that brings together social services and the psychological counseling with the medical service and packaging everything together.
It goes along with integrated health, you know, mental health, behavioral, public health, all being part of.
Yeah, I think
health.
We need to be looking at it through the RHA and through, yes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if maybe the presentation she can give to the county counselors, even though it's not per se public health, it's all this work, different organization, but it's something that's important in public health.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to do another presentation here and invite our counselors to our meeting and talk about the work, because it is our priority issue, you know, working on ACEs, and then talk about the alliance and show the you know, just make it a really tight presentation. And we haven't had a regular meeting with the council for some time now, and it's time to do it again.
What I was thinking, some of them did come to the workshop we had at one time, but I think it'd be a great reminder.
Yeah, we've been talking about, the new council is just got being seated this month, but this is a real opportunity in the new council, and we've actually talked about
April.
Yeah, what was April? We thought about getting them together with this. Yes,
because really a lot's been done, not just the alliance.
Well, and also for the Board of Health, I believe it's in February, we've got the ACEs update on the Board of Health as well. So with our new counselors, we're trying not to inundate them with all this information, but we do want to strategically start getting them in the dialogue and talking to them about these things. So Our public health and action piece is the ACEs Action Alliance for February.
Cool. And those of you who haven't read the ACEs study, you can Google the ACEs study, or Turning Gold into Lead is the name of Folletti's study. And then some great websites are ACEs Too High and Resiliency Trumps ACEs from different counties in Washington have come up with. We have just a ton of material on those websites.
We'll get a lot of this to Lydia to put in the minutes.
Okay. You guys can come to the board meeting on in February as well.
Certainly.
Yeah.
If you want to find it actually sooner than that, you can go to www.ted.com and just search for a Native American Heritage. You'll find it. I just did it on my phone. Pretty quick.
Tech whiz.
You know, we need to follow the model with this, just like we did with our Growing Healthier report, where we spent a fair amount of time educating the commissioners at that time.
And the Growing Healthier report lives again, so it's there, still there.
To say our leadership team is very supportive of bringing ACEs to the Board of Health even sooner than this, and I kind of said, well, can we wait till we have some real accomplishments to share? So I think this is getting to be a good time to bring that in, so we not only just set the stage with what ACEs are, but also can say what we've done. We have quite a bit more too that we've been doing up in Battleground, so I want to include a little update on that as well. We received funding from the Community Foundation, about $50,000 a year for 3 years, to do work up in just Battleground itself. And the reason that we picked that area was, well, we had great support from FAC for that, because we had a couple of FAC members that are serve that community, but also they just received the AWARE grant because of their high rate of youth suicide in that community. So we thought it would be great to bring ACEs in and overlay that ACEs education to provide context for all of the other types of initiatives that they're doing up there. They're doing mental health first aid, and they're doing a lot of counseling services and through the schools and a variety of other things. So we've been working with a number of partners up there, the Battleground School District, Battleground Police Department. Connect Battleground has been really instrumental up there. Their mentoring collaborative, Prevent Together, which is their prevention coalition, the Battleground Free Clinic, the Seventh-day Adventist Church and School in Meadowglade, Mill Creek Pub is our first business up there, and also the residents. So we have a really neat kind of steering committee, a coalition that's forming in Battleground to promote this. So some of the trainings that have already been done up there is I presented to Connect Battleground in September. Dr. Saring Lua will be presenting. I'll be going to an interview with the congregation, and he'll be presenting to them an after-lunch presentation this coming Saturday at the Seventh-day Adventist Church and the Free Clinic. And then I want to pass this around because there's room in the morning session and possibly even in the afternoon one. We're bringing Dr. Jody McVitty to town from Seattle, and she is, I saw her present at a conference that was sponsored by the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, OPI. And she's fabulous, and I loved her because she makes it really, ACEs really understandable, but she takes it to the next step and really talks about what you do with it. I mean, how do you really use this when you're working with kids or with each other or whatever. She explains in terms of brain development and teaches you great tools to use. So I just loved hearing her speak. She'll be doing a 3-hour workshop in the morning and a 3-hour workshop in the afternoon. And the registration link is on the flyer, and we really hope that some of you might be able to make the time to come that morning. So we have that going on, and then we also talked with ESD 112 about some of this marijuana tobacco funding, and because this is kind of the upstream solution for addiction and so forth, they're going to be helping us to pay for more screenings of paper tigers, more panel discussions, bringing more speakers to town, and doing kind of a really dream we had, Joan, of bringing more speakers and doing more presentations. So we're excited about that. So I also heard that you all like to hear a little bit more about mental health first aid, but before I go on to that, any questions about what we're doing in Battleground or with the Action Alliance?
Excellent work, yeah.
It's amazing because every minute we were at Leadership Clark County a couple weeks ago, and my buddy here, Greg, and they had a session on education, and every one of the superintendents that were there talked about ACEs and trauma-informed schools, so it was really exciting to hear. So Youth Mental Health First Aid is one of the programs that the AWARE grant has brought up to Battleground. It may be being implemented other places, but I know that it's a really big component there. So I found out a little bit more about that to share with all of you. This is a national curriculum that was originally developed in Australia, but it was adopted here in this country as part of the Obama administration's response to the Sandy Hook tragedy. And so the AWARE grant in Battleground is providing for training 13 trainers. So they're doing train the trainer types of work. They do three this year, and I think a few more next year, a few more the next year, and so forth. And so eventually they will have a cohort of 13 trainers that can do this in the community. They will train 500 participants this year. So the audience for mental health first aid for children is actually adults. So they're training 500 adults that work with kids. And the training components are that they take a first aid approach. So it's not like you learn how to counsel people or anything, but you provide first aid to someone who really has that capability to come in and work with the student or the child in a more formal and in-depth capability. So they help to identify the difference also in this training program between typical adolescent behavior, which you might sometimes think means they have mental illness, speaking as a mother of teenagers, and actual mental illness. So they really help adults to differentiate between the two. I hope I hurt one's feelings with that. And they use what they call the ALGI approach. So that stands for assurance. So you assure the person, you listen non-judgmentally, you give information, you encourage professional help, and you encourage self-care. So this is what the whole program is, and it's taught over the course of 8 hours. And the train-the-training program is 40 hours. And they so anyone can attend this 8-hour training. If you work with kids or you have an interest in that or you have kids, you can sign up to go to one of these trainings and become mental health first aid trained and certified. So if you want to register for that at Battleground, there's no fee because it's covered by the grant. And so if you want to take this down, the website where you go to sign up is YMFA, Youth Mental Health First Aid BG. So YMFABG.com. Or you can go to Connect Battleground and they have a link to it there as well.
And we'll put that in the notes too.
And there is an adult complementary program that's adult mental health first aid, but I found out about the youth one for right now. But and also I was trying to find out a little bit more about the resiliency.
The NAMI training, Stephanie, I think you asked about the NAMI training, and we're still trying to get some information on that, right? Yeah. So as soon as we do, we'll see.
Yes. And if you happen to have any interest in attending the Saturday's training that Dr. Lee will be providing, I brought flyers for that as well, so I'll just load you up with paper.
And also, Pat, I believe you have some flyers about the NFP program as well, so
yes,
if anyone is interested in those, too.
I'll send them around for you.
Okay.
No one has any more questions. The last part of the meeting is, I mean, anybody have any comments on anything at all?
Thank you.
How's our food doing this year?
How's what?
How's the food doing this year?
Oh, it's not much yet. So, yeah, it seems like, I don't have the data with me, but yeah, we're not seeing much. Not in Washington or Clark County for that, no.
What month is usually?
Oh, it can occur any time between like October and I mean, I've seen it go into April, later, but generally it's often, December, January, over. I mean, we're not at, I mean, if you haven't gotten a flu shot yet, you should still get one, so we're not out of the woods, but it just doesn't seem like we're gonna, so far, just not seeing much.
So we're not seeing much flu, but gonorrhea.
Yeah, well, we're seeing more STIs, and one of the concerns that folks have is that, and I didn't bring my notes with me, but I'll just do it off the top of my head, now that HIV is more of a chronic disease and it is a terminal diagnosis, and that we have things like prophylaxis available for people who have partners who are HIV infected, that some people may be taking more chances in terms of using protection. So, that may be one reason we're seeing more gonorrhea. So the numbers are up a bit, but so we need to get information out there.
Yeah, there's been
still with us, huh?
Public health has been a lot in the news with you know, the water in Flint, Michigan.
That's really, there's no excuse.
Yeah, there's the, you know, the more you learn about that. And then the other thing is the, I mean, I was on the Big Island with dengue fever and I was in the hot zone, but they're doing a great job of, you know, fight the bite, you know, the whole, in the dengue fever. And then also that,
Zika.
Just, you know, it's all around.
So Zika is a virus that can actually cause pregnant women get infected and cause microcephaly and severe developmental disabilities.
Is that from mosquitoes?
I think it's arthropod. And, you know, and yes, we don't see it in the United States yet, but yes.
It's basically around the equator. I mean, it's right in that area right there.
Zika's
has gone completely around the world now. It's a pandemic, considered a pandemic around, because it's all over now.
So
I was going to address that at the closure of our meeting.
As the weather changes, or as the climate changes, a lot of these things may not remain in the tropics, like dengue fever is moving north. And
it's, most all of these things are passed by mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes were there by the beach prevalent. That's what's happening.
Yep.
Any other comments? If not,
let me just say something here while I have the floor for just a moment. I was just reading about the Olympics, which the Summer Olympics, which are going to be in Brazil. And this is what
Zika and the pregnant
pregnant all that. I just took a few notes here. I just wanted to pass on along. This is going to be an interesting Olympics if they all get it together. They've only got 7 months now before it's going to happen. They're currently building, or hopefully building, a 16-kilometer subway that's going to be from the city center to the Olympic Park, which is supposed to be taking 300,000 people a day to the center. And they're out of there, they need about $247 million more dollars to pay for it. And they're having problems with the government because the government is corrupt. The president is possibly facing impeachment plans. This is all happening in Brazil. If they do get it finished, they're looking to get the subway finished by the July the 1st, but the Olympics start on August the 5th, so they have no, that's their window to see if everything's got all the little glitches and everything can be done before that time. And if they don't get it working, they have no plan B. So there is no plan B there. They're facing all of these, as you said, the dengue fever. And also another one,
chikungunya.
And Zika, which are all basically, again, carried by the mosquitoes. They've got 1.5 million cases of Zika in Brazil right now. They've got records of that. There are a couple of bodies of water that are close. This is the main reason I put this caught my eye, because of the health. There's a couple of bodies of water that has that are expected to be used for the Olympics, and they have sewage problems there, and with many viruses, and there's no plan for that at this time. There's just no plan for it. One of the United States persons who is an expert on water viruses and everything said that if this was in the United States, it would be closed by right now. I
mean, unless it was in Flint, Michigan.
Unless it was in Flint, Michigan.
Drinking in Flint.
And they have, as of December the 31st, they have sold less than 50% of their $4.5 million tickets, which was also going to be one of their things that we're going to have budget that they were going to help. So we'll see how this Olympics gets together in 7 months. You know, I can't even imagine with with the diseases, the viruses, and everything like that, people are not going to want to go down there.
Yeah. It's all because they lost the World Cup.
That's it. That's it. That's it. Thank you very much.
We're adjourned.
I sat and looked at my
name
the whole time.
Sometimes it's good to remember who you are.
Oops, I'm so sorry. You're fine. Crazy dragon.
What time is that meeting on the 20th?
1:30.